Right. Well, while there has been a great deal of debate about what the rule of law actually means, one thing is certain, and that is that it requires that government cannot dispense with the rule of law or cannot dispense with laws and must itself obey the law, and that includes the Constitution. Now, despite this certainty, governments in recent times have taken a much more cavalier approach to the rule of law. They instead ask what they describe as the rule of constitutional risk. Now, this involves assessing not only what the risk is that the Commonwealth is acting unlawfully in relation to particular actions, but also the risk that someone will bring legal proceedings that reveal that the government is breaching the law. And if that risk is low, then the government is prepared to continue acting unlawfully. Essentially, it seems that the rule of law has been replaced by the rule of what you can get away with. Now, this is starkly evident when it comes to funding grants to community bodies. Governments these days make grants blatantly and unashamedly on the basis of obtaining political advantage rather than on the basis of merit or need. Now, this results in the unfair distribution of public funds, the funding of unworthy or even unviable projects. We often see funding withdrawn because it was never possible to do the project anyway. The inefficient allocation of scarce resources, poor planning, and a lack of coordination with other levels of government in providing appropriate local facilities. In short, it results in bad government. Now, the exorbitant costs of such schemes, which now runs into billions of dollars, also imposes a heavy economic burden on the country, and particularly on future generations. During a time when governments are having to run huge deficits to deal with a pandemic, you would imagine that some effort would be made to pull back on unnecessary and wasteful spending of public funds for political advantage. But no, the younger generation will pay and will pay enormously in the future for the profligacy of government vote-buying schemes today. And let's be clear, these schemes are primarily used for vote buying. The sports rorts, scheme to swimming pools and car parks, none of these schemes fall within Commonwealth areas of policy responsibility, and all of them have involved grants being made, announced, or promised prior to elections, where the money has been largely targeted at particular seats held or desired to be held by the party in government. We've seen the colour-coded spreadsheets. We've read the Auditor General's reports. There is just no hiding this. Economists have also shown that such spending can shift votes up to around 2%. And in a tight electoral contest, whichever party has the advantage of incumbency, and remember, it might be the party that you oppose. Whichever party has that advantage can use public money to buy an election outcome. Now, politicians do it because it is effective at distorting democratic outcomes. They know this. It is not a miracle outcome. It is an election which is bought by taxes paid by hardworking Australian families. Now, most recently, it was suggested that the fact that the government won the election was justified such actions. Apparently, the votes of people have the effect of laundering the misuse of public money in vote-buying exercises because the exercise was successful. In my opinion, using public money for political party gain rather than public good is never acceptable, especially if it is successful in altering the democratic outcome of elections. But beyond the ethics of such behaviour is the issue of the rule of law. Is it lawful? And why does no one seem to care that it's not? The Commonwealth's Community Sports Infrastructure Grant Program, which is colloquially known as Sports Rorts, provides a classic example of breaches of laws and self-imposed government standards on multiple levels. The problems revealed in this program turn up in different combinations in various other programs. So not all of them will appear in car parks, etc., but some of them do in different variations. And these affect grants on swimming pools, regional grants, community grants, safer community grants, car parks, etc. Now, the problems are endemic throughout the system, and the flagrancy of the breaches is growing. Indeed, on the same curve as the coronavirus has been growing in Sydney, and that is exponential. So let's start with the Constitution. The first problem is the breach of Australia's most fundamental law, the Constitution. Now, it must be screamingly obvious to anyone without any training in constitutional law that the people who wrote the Constitution would not have intended or authorised the Commonwealth to deal with local matters such as resurfacing the local footy oval or constructing the local car park. Unsurprisingly, they gave the Commonwealth the power to deal with matters that involved international matters such as external affairs, aliens, immigration, defence, etc., matters that cross state boundaries, interstate trade and commerce, interstate industrial disputes, and things that need to be dealt with in a unified way across the country. So your currency, intellectual property, marriage. The Commonwealth Parliament was limited to specific heads of power and everything else was left to the states, including the establishment of local government to deal with local matters. Now, while some small aspects of the Commonwealth sports funding program might be supported by the external affairs power to the extent that they give equal access to sporting facilities to women and the disabled in accordance with some treaty obligations Australia has, the vast majority of grants do not fall within Commonwealth power and are simply unlawful. The High Court made it very clear in a number of cases in recent times, the Pape case and the Williams cases, that the Commonwealth Parliament must legislate to authorise the making of grants and that that legislation has to be supported by a Commonwealth head of power. The Commonwealth government, however, does continue to defy the High Court and keeps on spending on subjects that are not within its competence based upon this notion of constitutional risk. The calculation is that the only people who will have standing to challenge these grants are the recipients of them, and no one who is given a present rejects it and then sues the government for giving it to them. And unless you're Brian Pape or Ron Williams, two extraordinary outliers in relation to these matters. Now, what is most interesting to me anyway, is that while constitutional scholars, so they're not just me, but also Cheryl Saunders, Michael Cromlin, Jeff Lindell, and others have raised concerns about the invalidity of these grants on numerous occasions, including to parliamentary committees, the opposition makes very little of it, and it's not pursued, unlike all the complaints about bias in the giving of grants. There's plenty of noise and anger about that, but actually nothing on the legality of the grants. Why? Because the opposition also has an equal interest in unlawful spending in the future. They anticipate that someday they'll get back into government and they can then do the same things. Neither side seems to care sufficiently about the importance of the rule of law to put a stop to these breaches. Now, while the Audit Office has done sterling work in calling out bias in the application of grant money, along with inefficiency and waste, it does not make any assessment about the constitutional validity of the funding or even its legality because it does not have the legally qualified staff to do so. At most, it raises queries about the legality of grants, as it did in relation to the sporting grants program. In the absence of some kind of independent determination of unlawful behaviour, it is very hard to pin consequences on the government for their actions. But the obvious disrespect for the rule of law still does have an effect, even if it's not reflected in the ballot box. It seriously erodes public trust in government and compliance with the law by the public. People think, well, why should I have to obey the law if the politicians don't? And this is how corruption flourishes. It starts from the top. The more respect for the rule of law is eroded by people seeing it flouted on a regular basis by those who are in charge, the more we head into third world levels of corruption and graft. It is a dangerous path that our politicians are blithely pursuing simply to gain advantage at the next election. And I have to say, I ask myself frequently, don't any of them care about the serious damage that they are doing to the system of government by eroding respect for the rule of law? Do any of them think at all beyond the idea of winning? The notion abounds amongst politicians that the means are justified by the ends, that it's okay to abuse the rule of law and to make unlawful grants to buy an election outcome, because in the end, the success of your side in that election is for the benefit of the country. Even if that were objectively true, and people can have different views about it, in the short term, it is not true in the long term. The erosion of the rule of law and the seeding of future corruption are profoundly worrying. We are set on a trajectory with horrific ends. Yet our own leaders cannot see beyond the immediate glittering prize of the next election. Now, the sports rot scandal revealed more than breaches of the Constitution. It showed failures as a matter of law on multiple levels. So first here, we start with lawful authority. There was no lawful authority for the minister to make the grants. And this is because the statute allocated the grant-making function to Sport Australia, a statutory body, and the funds were appropriated to it to spend, not to a government department and not to the minister. The minister had limited powers under the Act to direct Sport Australia. Any directions had to be in writing, had to be tabled in Parliament, and no such directions were made. There was no power for the minister to act as the delegate of the commission in deciding which bodies were funded. The minister and Sport Australia could not even get their story straight about how the minister was entitled to act as she did. She said she relied on executive discretion. She's the minister, so therefore she gets to tell departments, etc., what to do. Except this wasn't a department, it was a statutory authority, and there was a statute which specifically limited her powers. Whereas Sport Australia argued that the minister wasn't making the decisions, even though the minister argued she was making the decisions, Sport Australia said that they just coincidentally changed all their decision-making to match her suggestions. Basically, the minister exercised a power because she wanted to, even though she had no legal power at all. It was unlawful. But neither the public servants nor Sport Australia called it out and stopped the minister. Indeed, Sport Australia actively facilitated it by abandoning its own decisions as to who should receive the grants and replacing them uniformly, 100%, with the decisions of the minister. Now, this suggests an overly compliant public service because the minister's own department did nothing about it and a servile statutory body. None of them were prepared to enforce the rule of law in the face of a ministerial desire to act contrary to it. The next area where there was also potentially breaches is in relation to financial legislation. There are legal obligations on ministers about approving and making grants under the Public Governance Performance and Accountability Act. Ministers must be satisfied that the spending of public money is efficient, effective, economical, and ethical. Grants made for political advantage in targeted seats are unlikely to satisfy those requirements. While there is no associated penalty in the Act for breaching that provision, it is still a legal requirement. It is law. Ministers are, according to the rule of law, required to obey the law, regardless of the existence of penalties. In addition, breaching this particular law would also be relevant to any administrative law challenge to their decision making. All right, next point, further area where there were breaches, grants rules. At the Commonwealth level, the grants rules are statutory rules and therefore have the effect of law. Ministers cannot approve grants without receiving written advice from officials on their merits and must record in writing the basis for their approval relative to the grant guidelines and the key principles of achieving value for money. Now, these are very sensible and appropriate rules. If ministers approve grants that are not recommended, they must report to the finance minister giving their reasons. Now, in the case of the sports grants, it was claimed that these rules did not apply. Why? Because it was a statutory authority rather than the minister who was making the decisions, despite the fact that the minister thought that the minister was making the decisions, and so did Sport Australia. Nonetheless, at least on my reading of the rules, they did apply to the minister in these circumstances, and the minister did not comply with them. And even if they didn't apply, Sport Australia had an equivalent set of rules, and there was no compliance with their rules either. Finally, we get to the issue of administrative law. Yes, it is law. When ministers are decision makers, or even when public servants are decision makers, they must obey the rules of procedural fairness. They must act within their legal power. They must not act for an improper purpose. They must not take into account irrelevant considerations. They must not act in a biased way. And let's face it, it would be difficult in the face of the Auditor General's report to see how the minister's behaviour was consistent with all of those standards. So you see, on multiple levels here, serious problems in relation to the rule of law and the application of it in relation to this example. So some suggestions as to what should be done about it. Okay, first one, and you may think this is a bit odd, but I think it's actually really important, education. We need to educate ministers and their advisors, so the people in the ministerial offices, as to the constraints on ministerial power. It became apparent during the parliamentary committee hearings that the minister had no idea about the true scope of her powers and saw legality as a mere technicality which should have been sorted out by somebody else. Okay, I'm the minister, I get to exercise my powers. If there are any problems, somebody else should deal with it, but I should still be able to exercise the powers the way I want. The only education that ministers actually receive is in how to obtain power. They're very good at learning how to climb the greasy pole, but most of them are clueless as to how the government system works and how they must exercise the very considerable powers that they do receive, particularly under statute. Now, the importance of the rule of law and the obligation to comply with it needs to be explained and impressed upon ministers. Secondly, public service independence. There needs to be more done to ensure that public servants are obliged by law and as a condition of their service to inform the minister about any legal constraints on his or her power. They should also be protected from retaliatory action for giving ministers advice that they don't want to hear. All such advice should also be in writing and, critically, made available to any investigating parliamentary committee. Only then can there be proper accountability of ministers to Parliament. In the sports grants controversy, far too much material was refused to be produced by the government to the parliamentary committee that inquired into it, including all the legal advice, to the extent that there was any. Thirdly, the Auditor General's office needs to be properly funded through an independent method and to be fully staffed, including with a legal branch, so that people can actually make assessments as to the likely lawfulness of government action and the constitutionality of government spending, which is something that is not assessed. Fourthly, we need an effective and properly funded independent corruption commission to investigate allegations of corruption and to make public findings. And finally, we need legislation to be enacted to govern the grants process in a comprehensive manner so that grants are only given on the basis of merit and public need, following applications that are assessed by reference to publicly advertised criteria, following appropriate consultation with other levels of government. There should be no exceptions for election promises or because the administering body is a statutory body. So let me conclude here with just a couple of observations. First of all, if you raise these kinds of concerns with politicians, first of all, they'll roll their eyes and say you're terribly naive. And then they will say, first of all, well, the other side does it or will do it, so we should too. Now, look, frankly, you wouldn't accept such an argument from a 10-year-old, so you shouldn't accept it from politicians either. Next, they will say, well, these are all just technical rules and the ordinary people don't care about that. They just want stuff done and they don't care what level of government does it. So why shouldn't the government fund, Commonwealth fund these things rather than state or local government? But I think if you took a straw poll of whether ordinary people think that politicians should obey the law and the constitution and not use public money for their own political advantage, I'm pretty confident that they would agree and that they would care. Finally, politicians will say, oh, look, these are all good projects and we shouldn't be depriving people of football ovals or car parks, and your proposals would mean that nobody would get this money or these facilities. Well, look, if they are good projects, they can still be done through lawful means. Grants can be made to local governments through states under Section 96 of the Constitution to fund local sport, local car parks, and it can be done on the basis of merit and need in a properly coordinated and effective way. Complying with the law does not mean denying people facilities. On the contrary, it's in fact likely to result in more and better facilities because the money is more likely to be spent in an efficient, properly planned manner. But then the Commonwealth politician will argue, well, what is to stop the state or local government from applying the money, grant money, to their political advantage? So this is getting back to your 10-year-old's argument of saying, well, hang on a minute, if then somebody else does it, they'll do it corruptly, so I should be able to do it corruptly instead. Again, the answer here is proper laws and conditions being placed on funding to require that it be spent according to clear criteria and be done appropriately. Ultimately, there is no excuse for the abuse of government grants. It is wrong at every level. But worst of all, it undermines the rule of law and it destroys trust in the democratic system of government. Thank you very much. I'll end my rant there.